representative, encouraged me to run for council. She was the mayor, and she said, hey, I think you would be a great person to serve with me. I think we could get a lot of great things accomplished. And so I decided my entire time on the council was COVID. And so I was there when the government shut down businesses, when everything was in lockdown. I was there during the middle of it. Someone who is not just going to hide under the radar, but someone who will fight back against this Trump regime, this administration, and what they're doing to our country. And so before I get into it, let me back up a little bit and let you know how I got to this point. And so I grew up in Wisconsin to a working home. My parents actually worked long hours. They would come home around 6 o'clock, and me and my siblings had to take care of each other growing up. So my mom started in the manufacturing industry, and I'm so proud to be, you know, all these labor signs behind me, because we grew up in a very much labor-focused family. His own business fixing computers at a time when not many people had computers. So I did learn about technology at a really early life. I spent my first, you know, time working, you know, had hand-me-down clothes. Me and my brothers relied on our school's free lunch program just to get by. My sister dealt with medical issues her entire life, and I'm sad to say she unfortunately lost the battle to that. And despite my parents having to go through that heartbreak, it was not enough why I decided to run for Congress during this time. One, as I've said and I always say, I feel as though the working class has been left behind, especially by this administration. But this is going back further and further. As someone who knows what it's like to live paycheck to paycheck, I understand right now that life is increasingly becoming too unaffordable for individuals and households, be it grocery prices, now electricity prices, healthcare, you name it, everything is going up. Gas, I just saw the other day, it was under $3, and now it's almost $3.20 right now because of what's happening across the world, thanks to this president. And so while we are struggling just to get by, just to afford basic necessities, we have politicians in DC who are busy fighting for more power or getting in, you know, participating in insider trading to make themselves more rich, while we, the working class, the everyday person who keeps our economy going, is struggling just to get by. So that's reason number one. Reason number two, and this is probably pretty obvious, but our current congressman, quite frankly, is a clown. I could go on and on about his poor performance, but just a couple of things. I mean, it's been over a year since Glenn Grossman has hosted an in-person town hall, preventing his constituents from even talking, even just getting basic information about what's happening in our country. That is the base level responsibility of a representative, is to let their constituents know what's happening in our country and what they're doing. That's not happening. Glenn Grossman has a 10% rating, lifetime score with the AFL-CIO. I was just at a labor dinner last night in Fond du Lac, chatting with folks from different unions and labor groups, and the response every time I said, hey, I'm running against Glenn Grossman, it was typically a very nasty response based on his performance. Glenn Grossman is not an ally to labor, to unions, or the working class. He voted for what I call the bigger bullshit bill, which adds $5 trillion to the national debt and cut $1 trillion to our health care, where low-income families relied on that just to get their basic needs met. And as we've seen and how he has voted, he does not support releasing the Epstein files and holding people accountable. Based on everything we've seen, he has yet to give a statement on even the state of things that are happening around that. He's on the oversight committee. He is the person who should be asking the tough questions, who should be holding folks like Pam Bondi accountable. Thank goodness she is no longer in her position. But instead of asking these tough questions, holding them accountable, he spent his time praising her for the work that she's done. It's laughable at this point. And so, like I said, I can go on and on about Glenn Grossman's poor performance, but what we've seen and what we know is that we are not even getting the very basic, the low bar of basic representation from him. And so we're seeing across this district that people are fed up with it. And I've talked to Democrats, independents, and Republicans, and they are not happy about what's going on. They're not happy with the Trump administration. Basically, every promise he made, he's completely done the opposite of it. And so I see a great opportunity to flip this district this year. It is a tough district. We have had Glenn Brokman for the last 12 years. We've had some great candidates in the past, but I think a lot of it does have to do with timing. And this is a time when people are fed up with what is happening in our country, the current state of politics, and they want something new. It doesn't matter if you're, what party you have behind your name, they want someone who is going to engage respectfully, talk to them like a human being, someone who has actual policies, and I look forward to getting into those and answering your questions about them, but also someone who is gonna call out the bullshit when we see it, who is not afraid to say, no, that's not correct. You are not accurately representing what's happening. And I know you all seen on social media and in the news the amount of lies that have come out from this administration and Glenn Grossman's lack of spine to stand up to those lies and tell us the truth. And so, again, I'm Aaron Wojciechowski, or Wojo, and I'm really excited to be running for this position. We're in a very competitive primary, and I'm honored to be one of the leading candidates as of this time, having raised the most funds, having great social media outreach, and inspiring young people especially. We know that the next generation has to be engaged, and they have to be the force that helps us get over that finish line in November. And so I'm incredibly honored to be here, especially paired up with Kelda, who will be speaking after me, a great friend of mine, and a great legislator and leader. But we have a real opportunity this year to flip not just the House, flip our state legislature, retain the governorship, and make sure that we have a government that reflects our values and that will fight for us and actually tell us what's happening in our country. So that's my intro. I'm here to answer your
Thank you, Gabe, and I'm delighted to be back here in Sheboygan County. I feel like I was just here, but actually everywhere I go in Wisconsin, I'm like, I was just here. I'm delighted to be here. My name is Kelda Royce, and I'm running for governor for two very important reasons. First, we are living in a very dangerous period in American history. We have an authoritarian regime in Washington that is shredding our Constitution. They are undermining the rule of law. They have unleashed a violent paramilitary force against us in our communities, and we need a governor with a spine of steel who will use every tool at her disposal to protect us from the many harms of this Republican regime and to do her best to try to bring our democracy back from the brink. Secondly, and this is a more hopeful note, those of us that have been in rooms like this over the last 16 years know that for about a generation, Wisconsin's been a pretty tough place to be a Democrat. And that's because we've had the most gerrymandered legislature in the history of the country. But that is coming to an end. And so now looking forward, we need a governor who won't just veto bad legislation, but we have a small window of opportunity in 2027 after we flip the state Senate Democratic, and with an assembly that is going to be very, very close one way or the other, we could actually get something done in the state. If we have a governor with the experience, the knowledge, the skill, and of course, the commitment to make progressive change. Those are the reasons why I'm running for governor. So for those of you who don't know me, I'll give you a little Kelda Royce 101. I was born in Marshfield, Wisconsin. I spent my early years in rural Taylor County, where my family lived in a one-room schoolhouse and I had a pet goat. Our closest neighbors were Amish. And for those of you who are not familiar, this is Wisconsin. Medford is roughly there, and we lived outside of Medford, north of Highway 29. My family later moved to Madison, where I graduated from high school. I went to the University of Wisconsin Law School, where I worked on the Wisconsin Innocence Project. So if anybody's curious about my thoughts on criminal justice reform, we can set aside another 5 hours to talk about my detailed plans for how we can fix our state and be focused on public safety. And then after law school, I didn't do what a lot of my classmates did and go work for a big law firm and make a lot of money. Instead, I became the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Wisconsin. I spent 4 years traveling this state, building progressive power, and working to expand access not just to abortion, but to contraception and sex education, to bring down our state's shameful infant mortality rate. And that's work that I have continued throughout my career. I also helped to pass the first pro-choice law in a generation in Wisconsin, the Compassionate Care for Rape Victims Act. And when I say I know how to get really difficult progressive things done in tough legislative environments, I want to let you know that we passed that legislation when we had a Democratic Senate and an anti-choice Republican Assembly. So I do know what I'm talking about. And I've been doing this for 20 years. I then ran for the State Assembly kind of unexpectedly. I was the underdog candidate, but I knocked on 20,252 doors and won that primary and came in 2009, which was the last time Democrats had the trifecta. I was so excited because, of course, there was so much that we wanted to do. I became vice chair of the health committee, and we helped expand Badger Care to 80,000 previously uninsured Wisconsinites. So while a lot of candidates talk about, oh, I'm going to expand health care, I've actually done it. I've helped to do it. And that was the last time we expanded Badger Care in this state. We left a lot undone in that session. And that's one of the things that haunts me and drives me in this campaign, because I know how fleeting it can be to have the opportunity to make change. And I am determined that we will not waste the opportunity that we are about to have next year. We all know what happened in the next election after 2009, right? Scott Walker came in and we went from a completely blue state to a completely red state. And the first thing he did was to attack teachers and nurses and our public schools and our universities. And then he went after private sector workers. And you know what? Our economy has never recovered from the money that was taken out of families' pocketbooks over that time. So one of the things I'm committed to doing as governor is raising wages, both the minimum wage and repealing Act 10, and restoring collective bargaining rights for all workers in this state. Everyone should have the ability to join me. Now, in 2013, I left the state legislature, and I went on to start my own small business. It's a tech-enabled real estate company that makes it easier and more affordable to sell a house or buy a house. And I'm very passionate about expanding access to housing and have a lot of detailed thoughts about that. But I'm also passionate about small businesses and making it possible for any Wisconsinite who, like me, has an idea or a dream, has a strong work ethic and that little bit of crazy that you need if you're going to start your own small business or run for office for that matter, that they can actually do that in Wisconsin. And I've worked as a legislator and as a small business advocate to try to make Wisconsin a place where people can start a small business and thrive. And by decoupling some of the core benefits that people need, like paid family leave, health care, access to a secure retirement, decoupling that from employment, we can actually unleash a lot of economic growth and potential in our state by making it possible for people to start small businesses. Now, in 2020, I was elected to the State Senate, where I now serve, and I work on the Joint Finance Committee, which is the committee that writes the state budget. Now, this is important because I'm the only candidate running for governor that actually does have deep knowledge about the state budget from having worked on it. I know where the Republicans are hiding their money. And I also know where it needs to go. Namely, it needs to go into our public schools. Our public schools that have been starved of resources for 30 of the last 32 years. And also to our local governments, who are trying mightily to provide a high level of service in the midst of declining state funding. I'd love to talk a little bit more about public education, because I really view it as our core constitutional responsibility at the state level. I was actually sued a few weeks ago in my role as a member of the Joint Committee on Finance, because education advocates, parents, teachers, and school districts recognize that our schools have been so underfunded for so many years that we are now failing to provide the quality free public education that is a guarantee, a birthright of every child in our Constitution. And so I welcome this lawsuit, because I think we're right. Our kids deserve better. You know, my parents chose to be in Wisconsin from coming from other places because they knew, as a family of pretty modest means, that their kids could have a good life because of Wisconsin's high-quality public education system. And we did. You know, first in rural northern Wisconsin, great public schools, and then later in Madison. And I worry that kids today are not getting the same quality of education. Our teachers are overworked, they are underpaid, they do not have the resources and support that they need. And we can see that in the offerings that our school districts are able to create, and we can see that in the outcomes. So as governor, I will be focused on education from early childhood to K-12 public education to our great public higher educational institutions. Wisconsin will be the education state once again when I'm governor. And I want to talk a little bit about where that money is going instead of our public schools. Certainly a lot of it is going to tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires and big corporations. We know that that is true. But another big piece of it is money that is going to private, unaccountable voucher schemes. These are private schools that do not meet the same standards that our public schools are required to. Many of them are religious in nature, and they are free to discriminate against teachers and students, even though they get public money. I am the candidate in this race that has a responsible plan to bring this failed voucher experiment to an end and make sure that that money goes into our public schools instead. A couple of other issues that I think are really important in this race. Obviously, cost of living. And the big ticket items really are healthcare, housing, childcare, and utilities. And I have detailed plans on my website to bring down the cost of all of these items. If you have to put my campaign on a bumper sticker, you could say, Kelda Royce is going to raise wages, lower costs, and protect our freedoms. Because those are the things that are really at stake here. I want to mention just a little bit about myself personally. I'm the mom and stepmom of 5 kids. I know, it's a lot. I always get a kind of a shocked response. I'm 46, and my 2 oldest stepdaughters are now in their 20s. They've turned out beautifully. We're still working on our 12, 8, and 4-year-old. But I'm deeply committed to this state being a place where every single person can thrive. It shouldn't matter who you are or where you're from or what you look like. Every single Wisconsinite deserves a great public education for their kids. They deserve to make enough money to be able to support themselves if they are working full-time. They deserve access to affordable, quality health care, like my plan to open up the state health insurance that I enjoy as a state employee to let anybody buy in. These are the basics. But we want Wisconsin to be more than just a place where you can get by, and a place that you can really, really thrive. I am confident that we can do that if we have a governor who knows how and is willing to use political power to get things done to help people. Our Republican opponents never hesitate for a minute to use and abuse their power. But they do it to hurt people, to divide and conquer, to take rights away, to destroy our rights and undermine our Constitution. We need Democrats to stop being so shy about using power. When it comes to being willing to throw a punch or take a punch for the children, as Nancy Pelosi said, I am that person. And that's why I'm the best candidate to be governor. And I ask for your votes on August 3rd and November, or August 11th and November 3rd. Thank you.
You mentioned that private schools aren't meeting the same standards as public schools. Can you go into more detail about those standards, please?
Yeah, so specifically voucher schools. So if you're a public school, number one, you have to take every student. You don't get to cherry pick and say, well, we like you, but we're not sure about you. And let's try you out for a month and then decide we don't like you, but we're going to keep the money that comes along with you. Yeah. That's what voucher schools do. Voucher schools can discriminate against a teacher because she's pregnant and unmarried, or because he's the wrong religion, or gay, or a student because they have a disability, and I think that's outrageous. Public money should be for public schools, period. Yes. But here's my plan to responsibly address this voucher scheme. The first step is you require the same standards, so your teachers have to be licensed. You can't just hire some rando off the street without a background check. Your kids have to meet the same academic standards. They have to take the forward exam so we actually know how they're performing. And you can't discriminate. You're not allowed to cherry pick either, you know, students or staff. And I think that alone is going to render a lot of the current schools that are receiving voucher money to just say no. We'd rather be able to continue running our schools the way we want to, and we're going to just say no. The second step is we have to treat Milwaukee and Racine and their voucher programs differently from the rest of the state. And that's because they are far more entrenched. They have been in operation for longer, and they serve a much higher percentage of students in those districts than the statewide expansion. The statewide expansion is relatively new, and what we know is that the vast majority of students that are receiving these vouchers were already in private school before the state started picking up the tab. So we say, first we require the same standards, non-discrimination, transparency, accountability, and then we're going to say, starting at the beginning of next school year, the state is no longer going to pay the cost of these vouchers in the statewide expansion area. And parents can choose if they want to move their kid to the public school or if they want to do what they were doing before and just continue paying out of pocket as they had previously been. Now for Milwaukee and Racine, as I mentioned, it is more complicated. And I do not think, at the end of the day, we have to do right by kids. And if kids are in an environment where they are thriving, I don't think it's right to take them out of that. Many of the students in those voucher schools, the public schools just do not have the capacity to handle that right away. So we need to set a date certain and say after this date, we will not accept new students into the voucher program. However, we will continue to allow anyone who is currently enrolled to be able to complete their education. And over time, then you can help the public schools build their capacity so that they can accept more students. And we're also going to give any voucher school that wants to the opportunity to become a public charter school, right? They can certainly apply to the school board to become a public charter, but then obviously they're going to have to meet the same standards, right, as public schools. So to me, that is the responsible way to address this while respecting the fact that public dollars need to be reserved for our public schools.
I'd like to know how in the world the reimbursement for special education and the per pupil funding aid are more for private voucher school students, a lot more than they are for our public school students. I don't understand how that's legal or how it's constitutional. I just don't understand.
Well, I think it's outrageous, and it's happened in recent years. We've had 8 Republican budgets in a row. And our kids cannot afford another Republican budget. Now, I have seen this up close and personal. And, you know, the Governor Evers writes pretty good budgets. His budgets have a lot of great ideas in them. And then the Republicans get a hold of it and they just put it right into the garbage. They don't even recycle it. They just literally put it in the trash. And Republicans do whatever they want in the budget. And the thing that has been the most consistent and the most important to Republicans has been cutting taxes for the wealthy to debase our public treasury and transferring money from our public schools to this private voucher scheme because the long-term goal is to undermine public education. We know that public education is the key to having a vibrant, functional democracy. It is the key to having a strong economy with a middle class. We can't do that without public education. But Republicans see a world where education is rationed based on your parents' wealth, based on the zip code that they can afford to live in. That's why they're content to let property taxpayers pick up the tab for way more of the public school system than we should, because it's inequitable. They're doing it because it's inequitable. Wealthy communities that will afford to raise their own property taxes can have wonderful schools, you know, with highly qualified teachers that are able to be retained, and small class sizes, and science labs, and sports fields, and areas of the state, often urban and rural, that don't have the same property tax base, are really going to struggle. And that's fine with Republicans, but it's not fine with me. Because education is a basic fundamental right, and it shouldn't be rationed based on your parents' wealth.
Yeah. Funding school by referendums. And I've seen a lot of the Marquette survey about pitting elderly taxpayers against our kids, you know.
Right.
That's not right.
It's not right, and it's so divisive and hurtful for communities, and it's terrible fiscal policy. I mean, who can budget like that? You know, the thing that school districts and municipalities and businesses need is consistency. They need to be able to plan. This is one reason that Trump has been so disastrous for the economy, is because you can't plan if you don't know what the future is going to look like. And if you have to, you know, just on this April ballot that's coming up on April 7th, where we are going to elect my friend Chris Taylor to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. She and I came up together in the abortion rights movement, and she followed me into the legislature, and it's very exciting that she's going to be serving on our court. So on April 7th, there are, I believe, 72 school referenda that are on ballots all around the state. Now, 10 of them are capital referendums, right, for new buildings or projects like that. 2 are combined, and the remaining 60 are operating referenda, just to keep the lights on, just to keep teachers in the classroom. And this is not unique. This has been happening in every single election, year after year. This is not a case where, like, oh, this school district or that school district is just bad at managing money. They don't know how to do it. This is systemic, it is on purpose, and it is totally undermining our ability to provide a high quality public education for all kids. My property taxes are too high, your property taxes are too high, and it is the Republicans' fault. They are the ones that have created this system. And as much as they're gonna yap about the 400 year veto and Governor Evers, the truth is, they control the legislature. They are the ones who have made these decisions year after year. And even in this session, we have given them many opportunities to fund our public schools appropriately, to prevent the very property tax hikes that we are now experiencing and paying for. They could have repealed that 400-year veto anytime. They have the votes, they control it. And a lot of Democrats would join them as long as they're willing to fund schools. They refused again and again. Why? Because they would rather have a political weapon to use against Governor Evers that you pay for, that we pay for out of our own pocket, than actually solve the problem. Yes?
Just a comment. You use the word capacity. I don't think the state of Wisconsin has the capacity to support two separate school systems and give every kid a comprehensive education and have it affordable. It's not affordable. They are backing themselves into a corner where they're going to continue to make the decisions that we're going to lessen the opportunities for the people in the public schools, and I think the day is coming when they're going to have to lessen the opportunities for private schools. But what has to happen now is they have to, you know, pull up their pants, whatever you call it, as far as making a tough decision, and stop the funding of private schools and slowly phase out, let the kids finish, you know, the track they're on to get out of it. And I emphasize that with my policymakers all the time. Mm-hmm. You guys and gals are backing yourself into a corner where you can't afford it. And since you can't afford it, you're going to reduce the opportunities for kids. That's bad news.
You're absolutely right. And you know what? This is an issue that is not just of concern to Democrats. I travel to some of the most conservative places in this state. On a daily basis, I'm talking with voters who are independent, voter swing, and even Republicans. I actually have Republicans for Royce. That's the only affinity group I have for my campaign. They are concerned about this too. And that's because, you know, whatever differences we may have, most of us really do want the best for our kids. We understand that education is the key. And the vast majority of Wisconsinites choose public education for their kids. Not homeschooling, not private education, even when it's funded by taxpayers. They choose public education because they know that is the best for their kids. And it's up to us to make sure that we are meeting the needs of kids. And listen, you know, I'm a parent, I'm a business owner. I know that just money is not going to equal quality, right? We have to have high standards for teachers and for students. We have to get the distractions and the screens out of classrooms. That's why I support a bell-to-bell cell phone ban. I don't think we should have Chromebooks for elementary schools, you know, other than if they're learning typing, right? We have to do other things, but you can't do it without money. And the idea that you can have quality schools but not pay for it is ridiculous. So you're gonna find me arguing for money for schools, not for its own sake, but because I want a high quality education, the best public education for every kid in Wisconsin, no matter who they are or where they're from. Yes.
I agree with you totally, but I guess my question is, this seems like a lot of this is a function of the legislature,
mm-hmm.
not the governor. You don't get the Donald Trump executive order overriding Congress power. So what can you do as governor to move the needle on this?
Well, this is a big difference, I think, between me and many of the other good folks who are running for governor. I have been working to pass progressive policy and build Democratic power for over 20 years in this state. And again, I have been able to get things passed in really tough legislative environments. Not just when Democrats were in control, but when Republicans have been in control, when we've had split control. And those skills are absolutely essential. And listen, even if we are lucky enough to have a Democratic trifecta, the idea that magic will just happen and we will end up with a properly funded school system and great health care for all, that ain't how it works. I wish it were, but I was there in 2009. And I love the legislature. I, you know, have spent 10 years in the Senate and the Assembly. Those cats will not herd themselves. There needs to be strong leadership from the governor. This is not a time where we can afford to wait for somebody to read a poll to decide, I don't know, should we fund our public schools and tax billionaires? We can't afford to have a blue ribbon commission to look at the issue of vouchers or whatever, or hold our finger up in the air and say, I don't know, is this going to be popular? We need a governor who is ready on day one, who has deep policy knowledge and convictions, and is ready to use all of her political power to get things done. So when I talk about throwing a punch and taking a punch for the children, this is what I'm talking about. We need to have a governor who will get all of our Democrats into a room and say, here's what we're going to do. Let's share our ideas. Let's do this together in a collaborative process, because politics is a team sport. You know, the governor might be at the top of the ticket, but the governor can do a lot alone, but not a budget. So we have to get the legislature on board. However, the governor must provide leadership. The governor cannot be trying to satisfy everyone, and that's why it's important to have a governor who actually knows what the hell she's doing and knows about these issues and knows where the money needs to go and where it's hidden, and can help the legislature. The vast majority of Democrats in the legislature are new. They're new since COVID, right? They're brand new to politics, even though they're smart people and they're from different walks of life, which is great. But, you know, the vast majority of Dems in the legislature have never, ever been in power. And so having strong leadership in the governor's office is important. Now imagine a scenario where we've got a Democratic Senate, which is going to happen, but we don't have a Democratic Assembly. We've got a narrowly Republican Assembly. Well, now you have a different framework, right, for how do you negotiate, how do you get something done? And again, you don't start your negotiations by saying, well, I'll just sign whatever they send me. That's how you end up with having a Democratic governor and yet the largest expansion of money going to vouchers. And no Medicaid expansion, right, year after year. That's not how I will operate as a negotiator. And there are many, many ways in which the governor can exercise power to bring people together. Procedural, there are carrots and sticks, right? I am well versed in all of those ways, and I will use every single tool at my disposal to get our priorities through, both budgetary and statutory.
So you were talking about money. This is tangentially related. In a recent report from the Wisconsin Department of Administration, they projected that the state's population will decrease by nearly 200,000 residents over the next 25 years. This is due to an aging population and declining birth rates. This demographic decline will shrink the tax pool and may cause labor shortages. How do you propose to reverse this trend?
Yeah, listen, Wisconsin is having a demographic shrink. We are a graying state, and this has been a long time trend. Now, it's not true in every area of the state. I actually represent the fastest growing area of the state in Dane County in the legislature. But part of the reason is because young people can't see this as a place where they can build a life, the life that they want. We've had brain drain for decades, right? Where we raise young people, we educate them, and then they go off to what they perceive to be greener pastures. And sometimes, like me, they come back, right? I came back for law school because of in-state tuition and a scholarship. And then I ended up staying. 16-year-old me would probably be appalled. But I think it turned out pretty well for me. If we want young people to stay in Wisconsin, we have to make it possible for them to buy a house before age 40. We have to make it possible for them to pursue the career interests and education that they want to, whether it's technical college, whether it's the trades, whether it's the military or a four-year university, or starting a business. We have to make it possible for people to afford to have children. As a longtime reproductive justice advocate and as a mom, one of the things that hurts me the most about this world that we've created for young people is when they say, I'd love to have a kid, but I can't afford it. Because I can't afford childcare. We recognize society's responsibility to educate kids. That's why we have public K-12 education and higher ed. But the most expensive and the most vital years are birth to five. That is when 90% of brain development happens. And we just say, parents, you're on your own. Congrats on your baby. Give us $100,000 so you can stay in the workforce until that baby gets to kindergarten. That's crazy. That's just crazy. So we have to have the structure in place and the public support so that young people can see themselves being able to thrive here. And by the way, there's also a cultural and a quality of life piece. I talked a lot about the economics and affordability, right? But young people don't want to live in a state that's polluted. Young people don't want to live in a state that's full of right-wing culture war nonsense where, you know, there's conversion therapy instead of gay marriage, where abortion is criminalized and there's, you know, no good sex ed in the schools. Young people want to live in a place that is forward-looking, where it feels like the government is there to help them and solve problems and not to stand in their way and drag us backwards.
Talking about decrease in population. This question has to do with are you an environmentalist? But before you answer that
yes.
part, before you answer that part, you talked about some examples that prove that you are.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that's happening right now, I think the world population is around 8 billion. You all hear all kinds of stories. Are we going to be able to support 10 billion people? Because we're getting hit, approaching that mark very fast. More and more people that consider themselves environmentalists are adding one other solution to dealing with it, and is that control our population. You know, slow down the growth of our population so we don't, challenge the kind of things that make our earth less healthy. So really the best way to do it, you know, not worry about population growth, let's worry about making sure that that population is dealing with things that are not going to stress our environment. So what kind of things have you done as far as making yourself consider yourself an environmentalist?
Well, I was raised to be an environmentalist because I was raised in Wisconsin, and to love and appreciate and play in all the beautiful natural spaces in this state. You know, you're going to find me on the shores of Lake Superior in March doing the fastest dip once that ice goes out that I can, and then I'm running immediately back into a warm sauna. Right? You're going to find me biking through our state parks. You're going to find me taking a hike with my kids, hike/amble, depending on who's with me and how fast they are or how much sugar they've had. And I do think that in terms of quality of life, it is one of the best things Wisconsin has going for us. By the way, it's also critical for our economy because tourism is one of our top three industries, along with agriculture and manufacturing. And agriculture is also heavily dependent on the environment. Now, Wisconsin has a long history of conservation leadership. In fact, my stepdad is a conservation attorney and, you know, somebody who has been on the forefront of putting together the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program and many of the environmental protections that we now have been enjoying for generations. So that is very important to me as an attorney, as a daughter, and as a lawmaker. I see it from all these different aspects. There are some very clear things that we know. Number one, climate change is real and it's costing us a huge amount of money. We need to help our state and our communities be more resilient to climate change, things like erosion in the Great Lakes and flooding and drought, wildfire smoke, right? All of these things are negatively impacting our quality of life. We also know that Wisconsin doesn't have any fossil fuels. So if we want to have energy, we either have to buy and burn old dinosaur bones that come from elsewhere, or we have to make our own energy. Fortunately, wind, solar, and geothermal work really well here, and they're also the cheapest and fastest new sources of energy for our state. So we can help reduce our carbon footprint, and I'd like to get all the coal-fired power plants offline over the next couple of years and replace them with lower energy costs and cleaner air. So we can all get behind that, right? I'll also say, I'm a big one on conservation, and probably this goes to my just being like a cheap, frugal, Midwestern mom. I love a deal. The cheapest energy is energy that we don't use, right? So expanding our successful conservation programs, our energy efficiency programs that help optimize our use of energy, requiring utilities to do integrated resource planning so we don't end up with overbuilding and then all of us have to pay the cost. This is another really important thing. We should have a focus on energy program that is for commercial and for industrial users. It works great for homeowners, but we need to really go after the biggest energy users and help them reduce their footprint. I have a lot of thoughts about the PSC and how we can help reduce our energy and decarbonize and have more clean and sustainable energy, but I'll leave those to if somebody else has a question about it.
You mentioned like natural disasters. Recently, I think it was last year, maybe the year before, Milwaukee and the surrounding areas were hit by a pretty intense flood. And to my knowledge, the Trump administration has not sent any type of relief funding for that. With, you know, the kind of hard stance that you're taking against the Trump administration, how do you see that playing out with, you know, requesting, negotiating federal assistance and at the same time pushing back?
I think my number one duty as a political leader is honesty. And I am never going to kowtow to a dictator because I think we'll get funds. I mean, nobody is nicer than Tony Evers. And we didn't get the funds. You just said it yourself, Gabe, right? So who knows how that person makes decisions? But I can tell you this. He has already reached the apex of his power, and his power is declining. And he will be held accountable. I don't know if it will be next year, or in 2 years, or in 3 years. But there will come a point, and we're already seeing it start to happen, where Republican politicians are not always going to go along with him. Not every Republican is Tom Tiffany. Tom Tiffany is a straight-up rubber stamp. The man has one thought in his head, and it's, what does Donald Trump want me to do today? That's Tom Tiffany. But not every congressman is like that. And I do believe that the way to get what we need as a state is to advocate clearly for it, to tell the truth, and to fight for it. Not to try to appease some dictator because we think if we say something nice to the dear leader that he's going to throw disaster relief our way.
Yes. I'm kind of asking a question that was asked of Aaron earlier, and that is about our elections being the way that we've always had them, and being worried about being preemptive rather than reactive, because once those go to the courts and, you know, they're contested, I hate to think what could happen. What are we doing, or what could you do legislatively? We have a special session coming up, maybe, to try to act preemptively to ensure that we have the free and fair election in November that we've always been used to.
I have never been more grateful for our extremely irritating and decentralized election system than I have been in recent years. There is no basis or mechanism for Donald Trump to nationalize the elections or to stop or halt the elections. We have free and fair elections in this country. And the most important thing that we can do, and all of us need to do it, is to assure ourselves that we still have our right to vote, and we will demand free and fair elections to proceed as they always do. If you haven't volunteered as a poll worker, do it. And bring your 16-year-old granddaughter or niece or nephew, because it's great to see how elections actually work. Now, will he try to disrupt? Yes. Will he lie and do all kinds of ridiculous propaganda? Yes. Will he abuse the court system as he did last time? Yes, of course. And I also think that a big part of what he's doing with ICE is to try to normalize violence and normalize the presence of, you know, creepy armed paramilitary on our streets, because it is one way that he can help undermine confidence in our elections and destabilize us. All of these things are real, and yet our only option is to continue to have free and fair elections in the state. And we can, you know, our Attorney General has been very on top of this with legal action. Our clerks, our municipal clerks, are well prepared, because the Wisconsin Elections Commission is absolutely on top of this. You know, Wisconsin was ground zero for the fake elector scheme. Ron Johnson, our U.S. Senator, somehow still our senator, was part of that. So we are not, the people who are working on these issues are very, very well aware and very well versed about the challenges and the threats that they face. And I have a lot of confidence in these nonpartisan actors and in all of the clerks and poll workers across the state that they are going to be able to administer a free and fair election. And we don't have another choice. We cannot give in to the cynicism and the fear. We can be clear-eyed about who the president is and what he's going to attempt to do, and also say it is our job to get out the vote and make sure that we are doing everything that we can. If you can volunteer to be a legal observer or an election protection volunteer or a poll worker, you can drive people to the polls. You can talk to people about how it is safe to go out and vote. You can help people to do early voting or vote by mail. All of these things are great options and places to channel all of the fear and fury that we rightfully have about this topic.
Kind of related to that, one of the worries I have about the election is the changes to the postal rules, because it does seem to be a way to suppress mail-in voting. People have said just bring it in, get it hand canceled, but it's still going to go to the distribution center and be get a postmark again, so you don't know when you're postmarked. And I just wonder if that's something that people have their eyes on, because people would have to get mail-in ballots in well ahead of it. You know, you can't just get it in at the last minute and assume it'll be postmarked.
Right, and there are many voting rights groups like the ACLU, the League of Women Voters, that are working to educate voters about these, the changes, and what are the best ways to get your ballot in. Obviously, you can turn it in directly to the clerk, to the municipal clerk. You can get it, mail it back the first day. And Wisconsin actually has an absentee ballot tracker. So you can actually go on myvote.wi.gov and see if your absentee ballot was received or not. And if it hasn't been received, you can actually go on election day and vote at your polling place. So there are a lot of fail-safe mechanisms in place. But to your point, one of the things that Democrats must do in the next session at the state level is expand voting rights. We need to make sure that people have full, longer periods like we used to vote early, to vote by mail, that people should be able to choose voting by mail as their default option. You shouldn't have to request it every year on New Year's Day. I say, you know, everybody make sure you, go to myvote.gov and request absentee ballots this year if that's what you want. You should be able to be permanently on that list. We should be able to have automatic voter registration in the state. We should be able to register students in high school so that they're ready to vote the minute that they turn 18. There's a lot that we can do to help elections run better and to expand access. You know, change our voter ID laws, which are purely a tool of voter suppression. There's no reason that an out-of-state driver's license or a student ID or a driver's license that's expired should not be considered valid for the purposes of voting, right? There's a lot that we can and will do.
When you become governor, you're going to have to work with the leadership in the Assembly and the leadership in the Senate. So Senator Lemahieu is my senator for this district.
Yep.
And I communicate with him all the time. And I have a nickname for him. I call him Boss Boss, because many times it seems he's running the showdown in Madison,
right.
Even more than the governor. Have you had experiences dealing, especially across the House, as far as with him and certain issues and stuff, talking to him? And then as a governor, what kind of skills are you going to use to be able to communicate with both? It seems that so many times those two fellows don't get together with the governor to take care of...
Or with each other.
Yeah, and with each other to take care of issues. So
yeah.
What would you do to fix that?
Well, let's just talk about it. So. Democrats are going to control the Senate, so Devin Lemahieu is going to be the minority leader, or somebody else will. Robin Voss is retiring, and happy trails to him. And that's going to be an opportunity for us, because there are many different factions within these caucuses, and in the absence of the iron fist of Boss Voss, that'll be an opportunity for us to talk with some of the members that maybe didn't want to go all the way to the far right, as Voss did, right? I mean, we just saw this happen on the fight over Gail's Law for breast cancer screening, and finally becoming the 49th state to expand Medicaid postpartum from just 60 days to a full year, right? So, you know, it was Democrats who demanded that on every single bill they offered those amendments and forced the Republicans to basically say, go to Voss and say, we have to do this or we're going to lose our elections. You have to let this through, even though you don't like it. And it worked. So I will just say, I'm a proud Democrat. We're all proud Democrats in this room. But I also have a very strong track record of working across the aisle over 20 plus years. And I'm really proud of that. And I think anybody who wants to be governor of this state should always be saying, here's not just what I plan to do, but here's what I actually have done. Here's my track record of delivering on bipartisan success. I'll just give you one example. I already talked about the Compassionate Care for Rape Victims Act. 4 years in the Senate, I was the only Democratic legislator on a bill called the APRN Modernization Act. This is a bill to allow advanced practice registered nurses to practice independently to the full extent of their training, right, and their licensure, and not always have to be directly supervised by a physician. Now, I thought this bill was really important because we have a provider shortage in this state, and we also have a nursing shortage, and if we are losing out on our most educated nurses, that's going to have a devastating impact on patient care. Republicans were actually, they were right on this issue, and the governor, our governor, whom we love, vetoed this bill several times. And it was hard for other Democrats who agreed with me to go up against our own Democratic governor. But eventually this session, we were able to compromise and get more Democrats to basically come on board that the governor ended up signing this bill. And it took a few years, but we got this bill signed into law. That's an example of me working across the aisle. It did not endear me to the governor or his staff. And some of my Democratic legislative colleagues were frustrated at me too. But at the end of the day, we had overwhelming support for the bill and it became law because it was the right thing to do for Wisconsin. As governor, I'm going to be very clear about what my values are and what my plans are, but I will always work with anyone to try to make your life better, whether you voted for me or not. And I'll tell you right now, I'm not just going to go after Democratic votes. One of the reasons that I think I'm the best candidate to beat Tom Tiffany is because I already have Republican support. People who want a governor who knows what to do, who is responsible fiscally and with policy, and who will govern Wisconsin the way that we ought to be governed, with good government, not MAGA nonsense, not platitudes and bullet points, but actual plans and policies and the political will to get it done.
Closing statements.
Well, I really appreciate having this chance to talk with all of you, and we have a really important decision to make. And I spend a lot of time traveling around the state and listening to people. So much of what I hear is the same, whether I'm in Trempealeau or Marinette or Beloit. Yesterday I was in Boucher and Wapaka, Shawnee, Beloit, and Madison. And you know, I was in Milwaukee on Friday. We are on the cusp of reclaiming Wisconsin's proud progressive heritage. We are a purple state, but we are also a blue state. And we can be a state where every single Wisconsinite, no matter who you are or where you're from, has the freedom to thrive. If we can elect a governor who is capable and willing to use political power to get us there. I want you to think about three things, because this is a political group, right? We're not the casual voters that stroll in on August 11th, not having thought about who we're gonna vote for, right? You guys are on websites, you're checking on boxes and being like, well, I like what she said about that, but I didn't like this. So we're not normal, and I say that with all the love in my heart, because that's how it goes if you're in a room like this. Think about three things. Think about who can beat Tom Tiffany. Who can help bridge that urban-rural divide? Who's talking about the issues that appeal to rural voters? And think about, for instance, Wisconsin's history of who do we elect statewide? People are like, I'll tell you who is skeptical. It's Madison, Dane County Liberals, my people. Mm-hmm. Can a Dane County Democrat win statewide? I don't know. Who's the most popular elected official in our state right now of either party? Anybody know? Mm-hmm. Senator Tammy Baldwin. Oh. Yes. Dane County Democrat, and a very important mentor of mine. Tony Evers, Jim Doyle, Russ Feingold, Dane County Democrats.
Also
who do, I'm sorry?
Also Plymouth, he's from Plymouth.
He's also from Plymouth too, yes. We can all claim him. Like, you know, Madison claims me, but Taylor County gets to claim me too, and Marshfield, right? We can share. And Portage, where my stepdad's from, you know. We have a really tough time in this state electing Democrats from the Milwaukee area. And I'm not just talking about Mandela Barnes, and that was a heartbreak race for all of us. I'm also talking about Tom Barrett, who ran twice and lost. And actually, Tom Barrett actually might be the nicest person in politics, even more so than Tony Evers. So we just have not had a good track record with Milwaukee area Democrats being elected statewide. Can a woman win? Absolutely. But if you're trying to elect a woman as governor, the number one factor is whether or not she has deliverables, whether she can show that she has experience, that she's gotten things done. And we've got a lot of good candidates in the race, but most of them are brand new or just a couple of years into politics. This is going to be a tough, punishing race where the worst people in the world are going to spend $100 million lying about our nominee. We can't have somebody that's making unforced errors. We can't have somebody that's going to be caught off guard by a reporter's question and say something dumb and then have to backtrack. We can't have somebody that's not ready to take the fight aggressively to Tom Tiffany for his terrible record of hurting Wisconsinites. We need a really strong candidate to withstand that. And I have been doing this for 25 years. I cut my teeth. Yes, you can clap for that. You can always clap. It's not television, I can hear you. I cut my teeth in my early 20s going on Fox News, on The O'Reilly Factor, and Laura Ingraham, and Christian Radio, talking about abortion. So, you know, and I've been a woman on the internet for 20 plus years, so you're not gonna catch me, saying something dumb or being unwilling to go anywhere, to talk to anyone, to get the votes that we need to win. I'm gonna go after the Evers Johnson voters and the Tammy Trump voters, and that's how we're gonna win. But the second thing you need to think about is who can win the primary. And we've got a crowded field, but the recent Marquette poll showed, to my delight and shock, that nobody, well, first of all, nobody's paying attention, right? The vast majority of voters are undecided. But even the candidates that are best known, Mandela Barnes and Rodriguez, have the highest negatives, and knowing their name does not translate into support. So all the candidates are basically in a statistical dead heat. We're all within 10 points of each other. The margin of error is 6.5% in that poll. And I haven't spent a dollar on voter contact, whereas some of the other candidates have spent tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. I am running for governor, and I know how you need to frugally raise money and spend it at the end on effective voter contact if we want to be successful and if we want to win. So this is a wide open race, which means that we can choose the candidate and back her early to help overcome the built-in name ID advantage that Mandela Barnes has if we want a different nominee in this race. But I need your help and your support early, right? I need you to give money. I have a little QR code back there and I have envelopes. I need you to sign up on my little clipboard so we can stay in touch. I need you to tell your friends and be evangelists and take a little button with my name on it. That word of mouth is what's gonna help us build momentum before I can afford to get on the air, to get my name out there. And that leads me to the third and most important point. This is our once in a generation opportunity to put our state back on the right trajectory. And who of all the candidates running do you think has the experience, the progressive values, the knowledge, and the utter commitment and drive to be best equipped to be our next governor? I hope you agree that it's me, and I hope you'll join Team Kelda and help build it together. Thank you so much.
I should call Patty Seeger because I don't think she's contributed to me yet this campaign, so I need to get money from her. Yes, I will. Well, thank you for your work.
Okay.
Yeah, appreciate it.
So how are you feeling?
I feel great. I feel like I'm getting a huge amount of momentum as I travel across the state. And it's really a joy to campaign when people are feeling like we're on the cusp of something different in Wisconsin.
So you mentioned the polling, obviously the 65% undecided.
Yeah.
How do you kind of parse that line of like, it's way too early to panic about what a poll says, but understanding like the people you're talking to now are the ones that could influence that 65% that are still out there?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that no poll before people have actually started paying for communications is going to tell you anything reliable about the electorate. And the most important thing that I can be doing is talking with voters and, of course, unfortunately, raising money, because that's the system that we have. But I am confident that we are going to have the resources we need to communicate and to win.
So is there anything of value people should be taking out of the polling this early other than people haven't started paying attention?
Well, I think they should take away the fact that this is a wide open race. And so people should back the candidate that they think is the best prepared to be governor, right? With the most experience or who shares their values or someone who can win. We're not stuck with a candidate just because they might have high name ID. That really doesn't translate to support. In fact, it translates to higher negatives.
So one of the things that's happening right now, obviously, there's a Supreme Court race. Are you seeing kind of that dovetail of tension of people starting to wake up to both things at the same time?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interest, obviously, amongst activists and donors and volunteers in the Supreme Court race. And I myself, you know, I'm helping launch canvasses and support Chris Taylor and raise money. And I'm confident that she's going to win. But I think after the April election, then more attention will be focused on the governor's race.
And does this kind of serve as a launch period that you have April, August, and November? You get them started now, you can kind of keep that momentum going?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, I've done a lot of political work over many, many years for a lot of candidates. And I have to say, I do think that people across the political spectrum really recognize that this is a crisis moment in our country. And they are looking for strong leaders who are capable of getting things done in a time when it seems like, you know, government is either attacking us from the federal level, like cutting our health care, putting these crazy illegal tariffs on. They want a state government that is going to be steady and reliable and relentlessly focused on lowering the cost of living for us.
Is it hard to have to deal with some of the questions of what will you do as governor about the election when it's the election itself that will make you governor? I mean, some of the timetable, people have that anxiety talking about that.
I understand people do have a lot of anxiety, and that's because we have a president who has shown that he will stop at nothing to try to silence his political opponents, to overturn election results illegally that he doesn't like. You know, he lies on a daily basis. He started a war, an illegal war with Iran, and now our gas prices are a dollar higher than they were a week ago. So when you have that kind of chaos and corruption and dishonesty at the federal level, it is understandable why folks are anxious about that. But it's also important that people know that our elections are safe and secure. There's nothing that Trump can do to stop our elections from happening. And we are going to demand that voters be able to cast their ballots and make their voice heard.
All right. That's all I need from you now. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, thank you.
Good to see you. Thank you for letting us know about that.